So we're going to tell the story of Esther this morning, and Esther truly is a woman that the world will never, ever forget. But before I tell you the story, there are three quick things. Number one, if you are kind of walking through the story with your kids, kind of as we have, as we've been encouraging you to do from the beginning, Esther's one of those stories where you're like, oh yeah, that's there. How do I explain harem to my kids? Like, there's some weird kind of moments in the story where you're like, how do I make this that which is R-rated, G-rated? Because it's all through this story. And we get into this morning, you'll kind of see just what we're talking about. So that's number one. Number two, we're going to put this slide up on the screen. How many of you have seen the movie 300? Can raise your hand. So in the movie 300, it's the great battle recorded between King Leonidas of Greece, the Spartans, against Xerxes, the king of Persia. Esther, this is her husband. So this is where one of those moments where kind of like world history actually does line up and collide with biblical history. So if any of you ever take a history class and you're learning about the great king of Persia named Xerxes, Esther is married not to this guy, but to this guy who is portrayed, because that's a weird guy. Anyway, this is who she's married to, is this particular king. And third, you're going to help me tell this story. And you have a vital role to play, and it's kind of like a reader response kind of thing. And you're like, I don't know the story. Well, listen, I have given you the simplest phrase that you're going to say at key moments, and it's really kind of a celebration of Persian pastime, what they did. And here's your phrase, and this is your cue. Whenever you hear me say, they were found guilty, they were taken outside, when you hear me say that, you will say, and they were impaled on poles. So just for practice... some of the moms are like, are you serious? I'm like, this is what you're reading with your kids tonight. So anyway, this is the phrase. So I'll say, they were found guilty and taken outside, and you will say, and they were impaled on poles. That's your memory verse for this morning. And they were impaled. It's all through the story of Esther. It's crazy. It's like, and they went outside for a picnic. It's just kind of like a matter of fact, this is what they did. So that's your cue. On the count of three, I'll say it like, and they were found guilty, they were taken outside. Julie, she's like, yes, I know this. I know this. All right, here we go. This is the story of Esther. Xerxes, it begins where Xerxes has had a huge party in his kingdom. And I mean a massive party. And after they've consumed much wine and much drink, he asks for his wife Vashti to come and parade around in front of Xerxes and all of his friends wearing nothing but her crown. Vashti refuses this. She is not going to lower herself to this level. And Xerxes loses his mind that his wife, the queen, has embarrassed. It's weird, like, you've embarrassed me by declining this request. But Vashti doesn't want anything to do with this. Vashti is essentially banished from the kingdom, never to really be heard of or seen of again. And this moment of defiance in his wife sparks what is the largest kind of talent search for the next queen. And all across the Persian Empire, they gather hundreds of women, the most beautiful women from across the Persian Empire. They bring them into Susa, the capital of Persia. And there they have this contest to see who will win the heart of Xerxes to be the next queen of his people. Esther, a Israelite woman who did not go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the wall, who just lives in the country. Esther is one of the women selected to come into this particular beauty pageant. Esther is brought in to be part of the king's harem. You can ask your parents what that is later. But she's a part of the king's harem. And she enters a 12-month, basically, beauty school. Fine perfumes, learns makeup, all kinds of things. Getting ready for the nights that she will spend with King Xerxes in the hopes that she might be selected to be the queen of Persia. After 12 months of this particular preparation, she's brought before the king several occasions, and she wins the heart of Xerxes. She is now the new queen of all of his empire, the empire of Persia. And she's never revealed to him yet the people group that she's from. Mordecai, a guy that you'll hear in a moment, asks of her, the one who raised her, do not tell the king where you're from. Do not tell him your nationality or your ethnicity, so to speak. Now, Mordecai, the one who raised Esther, he overhears two of Xerxes' soldiers planning an attempt to kill the king of Persia. He then goes, tells Esther, the new appointed queen of Persia. She tells Xerxes that two of your guys are going to have a time where they're planning to kill you. She gives all the credit to this information to Mordecai. Xerxes launches an investigation, and Bigthana and Teresh, the two men that were conspiring to kill him, they were found guilty, they were taken outside, and they were impaled by poles, just like that. That was kind of like, no other verdict for you, impaled by poles. Another guy named Haman enters the story, and Haman is elevated to be quite high in Xerxes' kingdom. And Haman asks and requires that when I'm around you, you will bow down and worship me. That's kind of vain, but Mordecai refuses to do this. This Jewish man who honors and serves the Lord just refuses to bow down and worship this particular guy named Haman. And Haman loses his mind. Haman, out of rage for one particular man, manipulates King Xerxes and says, there are a group of people that they separate themselves from the Persians. You should kill them all. And Xerxes is like, all right, let's kill them all. So they have this weird conversation that he's been manipulated into to go kill all the Jews that are living in the Persian kingdom. Now, what I find fascinating about this is the next day, after they've kind of made this arrangement, the save the date card is sent out to all parts in the kingdom. And it reads this way, on the 13th day of the first month, anyone who is not a Jew, you get to kill the Jews. This is the save the date card that goes out to the Persian kingdom. And Haman is absolutely ecstatic with this, that this one man and all of his people will be eradicated from Xerxes' kingdom. To speed the story up a little bit, Mordecai tells Esther, now is the time for you to act. Now is the time for you to somehow figure out a way to declare who you are, what race you're from, so that we might avoid this coming tragedy over you and all of your people. Esther meets with King Xerxes and she asks a rather bizarre question. She says, can we throw a party, a big one, just for me and you and Haman? Haman, when he gets wind of this, is over the moon ecstatic that the queen has invited just him into a party with King. How great am I? This is where his head gets full. He's filled with pride. He's bragging to all of his servants. I have been invited to a party with just the queen and just the king. Tomorrow is going to be awesome. I can't wait. Meanwhile, kind of back in the village, so to speak, two things are unfolding. One, Haman's hatred for the Jews is growing even stronger because Mordecai continues to not respond to worship Haman. And Haman builds this giant gallows that's 75 feet tall that he will hang Mordecai on the day that they have reckoned for all the Jews to be killed. So this is unfolding. The hatred continues to grow in Haman. And the second one is Xerxes, the day before, the night before of this day, Xerxes can't sleep. He is awake in the night. And while he is awake in the night, he asks for his king's history to be brought to him. Every Persian king, like any other king for that matter, they would record all of the greatness of who they are, the vast array of their battles, their wins, how big and strong their empire is. And he begins reading basically a history of himself. And while he's reading the history of himself, he runs across a little paragraph where this event where Mordecai revealed information to Esther that gets back to the king that spared his life. And he asks his attendants, did we do anything for Mordecai? I remember him, but I don't know if he did anything. So just kind of hold that in your mind. The banquet arrives. Haman is there with bells on. He's excited. Esther stands up and she reveals her nationality to the king, her husband, and makes one ask that Xerxes has granted to his queen. He's like, whatever you want, I will do, and I'll give you up to half of my entire empire. What is it that you want, my queen? And she says, and I try to place myself in the shoes of Haman in this moment. And she says, well, I'd like you to save me and the death that's coming to me and all of my people. The king is outraged, and he's like, who is planning to kill my queen and all of her people? this guy. Like, there's no other guess. And Xerxes loses his mind. That he discovers in this moment that he's been tricked by Haman to kill his queen and all of her people. Xerxes leaves the room in rage. And if you thought it was bad enough, that this is where the story goes. Xerxes leaves. Haman recognizes that, like, that his life is coming to a quick end. Because Xerxes, the most powerful man in the world, all of a sudden, obviously, is not pleased with him. So he begins to beg Esther for his life. And I can kind of picture this, like, kind of on his knees, kind of grabbing her dress, like, please save me from the coming death. And Xerxes walks in this moment and thinks that he's hitting on his wife. Xerxes declares Haman to be guilty, takes him outside, and he was impaled on poles. It gets even worse for Haman. You're like, well, how does it get worse than that? Well, Haman had 10 sons. And for whatever reason, which I don't quite understand from history, is that if dad or mom were guilty, anyone kind of connected to dad or mom, you suffered the same fate. So Haman's 10 sons were found guilty. They were taken outside, and they were impaled on poles. That's the story that you're going to tell your kids tonight. This is how God saved his people. It was through these bizarre series of events, because if you read all the way to the end, Xerxes undoes the decree where all the Jews are going to be killed, gives the Jews the freedom to defend themselves in case someone doesn't get the memo that the save the date event is now off. And God saves all the Jews, all the Israelites, through this particular story. What's fascinating is, at no time do we ever read about God in the story. At no time is God's name ever mentioned in the story of Esther. Which is weird, because if you've done any reading at all in the Old Testament, particularly some of the stories as of late, we quickly discover and read over phrases that read things like, and God spoke to so-and-so, and God moved the heart of so-and-so, and God caused this, or God caused... It's all through the narrative in the Old Testament. And these little phrases create clear signposts of God's engagement with his world. And then in turn, we are left looking for these same signposts in our lives. And because they are not clear signposts, like God said, God moved, God did, these clear moments, we are tempted to think, and we'll put this up on the screen, we are tempted to think that God no longer engages his world the way that he once did. Over the years, I've often heard people say to me, through coffees or just through pastoral visits and whatnot, I wish that I could see how God engages the world in our lives now the way that he did in the Old Testament, because it would be so much easier for me to follow and believe that God that's very clear in his statements and how he moves and all these kinds of things. In fact, as we've been making our way through the story, these statements again have made their way to the surface, and I can completely understand why. Every week we read something that says, and God acted, and God caused, and God moved, and God did, and God spoke. And again, all showing these clear moments of how God has engaged his world. However, I want to suggest to you this morning, those clear signposts, as we have been reading through the story, that isn't how the majority of us in this room will ever experience God's activity in the world or our individual lives. Most of us, myself included, most of us will experience his engagement, his activity, like the way we see in the book of Esther, a book where God's name is never mentioned. In fact, nothing is actually attributed to God in the book of Esther at all. It's just a pure story. Please understand this. The book of Esther reveals the kind of engagement that we will see from God in our lives and in our world. This is how the vast majority of us will come to experience how God engages his world now. And just because it doesn't sometimes clearly say it, it still says it very, very clearly. I want to highlight three moments, just three. There's all kinds of them, but I want to highlight three of these moments where God is the one bringing about, but it never clearly gives credit to him. But make no mistake, he is the one that's orchestrating all of these things with his grand purposes in mind for his people. Moment number one is when King Xerxes selects Esther, an Israelite of all people. of the hundreds of ladies that have been brought into, which now comprise to be the royal harem of King Xerxes. Hundreds of women are presented to Xerxes day after day after day. Xerxes has slept with all of these women, trying to figure out which one am I going to pick to be my queen. And oddly enough, of all of the women that have been brought before him, it's an Israelite woman named Esther that his heart picks, that he finds her the most attractive, that his heart is affectionate for this one, and this one will be my queen. It never really says it, and yet it says it. God is the one who moves in the heart of Xerxes, that causes him to pick Esther, the Israelite, as his queen, for purposes connected to God's agenda in a few short months, which we highlighted, where through Esther, God saves his people. The second moment is this, Mordecai. Coincidentally, is at the right time, in the right place. Of all the places that Mordecai could have ever been, he is right there listening to two of Xerxes' men plan to kill him. Mordecai then tells Esther, she in turn tells Xerxes, giving all the credit to Mordecai. Never really says it. God is the one who ensures that Mordecai is in the right place at the right time, connected to his purposes, which we saw in the story of Esther. The third moment is just Xerxes' sleepless night. Of all the nights that this particular king can't sleep, it's the night before the Israelites were going to be wiped off the earth, where he asks for his own history to be brought to him. It's this night where he reads the moment when Mordecai is the one that's given this vital information around his own life, where he asks, have we ever honored Mordecai? After the moment of kind of discovery with Haman and he's impaled on poles, what happens to Mordecai is pretty awesome. Like, he's elevated to be second in command of all the Persian kingdom. It never really says it, and yet it clearly says it. God is the one that causes Xerxes to be restless that night. God is the one that places in the heart of Xerxes for his king's history to be brought to him. God is the one that brings back to mind Mordecai, who is this particular gentleman. All, again, connected to God's plans and purposes for his people and his world. These are just three of the variety of moments in the story of Esther where God is sovereignly, personally engaged with his world, connected to his plans and his purposes, and it never actually says it, and yet it clearly says it. We see in the book of Esther the ways in which God is more often than not going to be about in how he engages us, a people in the 21st century. How he would speak to us, how he would lead us, how he would kind of bring things to bear, all with his grand purposes in mind, yes, for your life, but also for his world that we live in. So what I want to do for the remainder of our time this morning, some of you are like, you are just nuts. Well, maybe, but I don't think I am. I'm going to highlight some different moments just for your musing. To, if nothing else, force you to consider, maybe, just maybe, this is how God has engaged my life and I've just missed it. Because I'm looking for these clear signposts of a burning bush or a whale or something that's spectacular where I know for sure that this is God. And most of us look for these things and yet we miss all the subtle things that he's actually doing to engage our lives in one way or another. Let's start with the sleepless night. How many of you have ever laid there at night for reasons that you don't know why you're wide awake? And like never before, questions about life and its purpose and what you are in the midst of it are flooding your mind. Maybe, just maybe, this is God engaging you, bringing to bear things in your life personally that he's trying to get you out of your own way so that you can be a part of a great relationship with himself, a part of his plans and purposes for his world. Have you ever considered while you lay awake at night and you can't sleep and you didn't have pop, you didn't have coffee, but for tonight, for some reason, you are wide awake and there are things entering your mind that have never been there before. Maybe, just maybe, God's engaging you in a very personal way on that evening. The second one, the distraction. As a teenager, before I did something wrong, there were an awful lot of random things that happened right before I did something wrong. The phone would ring. Someone would come to the door. All of these random moments where I'm about to do something that I know is wrong, and there is a interestingly timed distraction. Maybe, just maybe, God is engaging you to say, you're about to bring yourself harm. Don't do what you were planning on doing. Maybe, just maybe, he's sovereignly engaging your life in this moment for profound things connected to his plans and purposes. The foiled plans, the third one. As a teenager, I had plans. Some of them were not very good. One particular evening, I was out with my girlfriend, and we were going back home to what was supposed to be an empty home. We were not allowed to bring our girlfriends back to Mom and Dad's house when they were not there. Knowing the law and having an ability to not follow the law, we made our way home, and my plans were foiled because I drove in. I'm like, what are my mom and dad doing here? This was not how this night was supposed to unfold. And I would walk in and kind of mad, but couldn't actually like be mad, because then the whole story, like, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here. And dad would explain, well, this happened, so we just came home. Awesome, you want to watch a movie together? Moments where it seemed as though God was foiling my plans to protect me from all kinds of things. I had good plans. I wanted to go on and be a gym teacher. God foiled those plans as well. Through a tour through what is now Crandall, but Atlantic Baptist University, walking through the halls and all set to go in one direction of my life, and God foiled my plans through a variety of neat, just beautiful things in a matter of a four-hour window of my life that forever changed my life. The promptings to do that come out of nowhere. How many of you have ever been just driving around doing your own thing and the list of a day that's just busy, and all of a sudden someone's name comes to your mind? The other day, driving around town, name comes to mind. I fire off a note, like, thinking of you, like, how are you doing, blah, 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 blah. And out comes all of these excellent expressions of how they're really doing. These moments where that name just comes to mind and you can't figure out why that name came to your mind today. Maybe, just maybe, God is engaging you to reach out to that person that's now in your mind. Words that are spoken just from someone else. I've been in a lot of conversations over my life where we'll be chatting and they will say something, and unbeknownst to them, they have said exactly what I need to hear into my life. They're unaware of it, but God's engaged me in that way in this moment. Please understand that God is very much engaged with his world still. Just last week, I had a coffee with a young guy in our church, and while we were having coffee, I could not help but notice the lady sitting next to us in the booth at Tim's was not even trying to hide the fact that she was eavesdropping. Like, it was unbelievably obvious, where I'm like, do you want to sit in here? Like, it was just obvious she was very, very interested in what we were talking about. By the time I had finished up that visit, this was a bit of the email that she sent through. She said, you seem like someone who isn't afraid of being asked difficult questions. I haven't encountered this with the church very often. Do you have any time to do another Tim's meeting in the future? I emailed her back, I'm like, have we met? No, we've never met. I can't imagine how I would ever have recognized you. I saw you and I immediately said, he's the pastor of Cornerstone. I've never been to Cornerstone. I can't figure out how I recognized you, but somehow I did. God's engaging her in profound ways. And I haven't stopped praying for her since, and we met for coffee this past Monday. And I don't know how, like, you could walk away from that and not see how God's trying to speak into our life, to do something, to undo, unfortunately, what the church has done to her over a long period of time. Don't ever let the temptation settle in that God no longer speaks to people, that he no longer guides people the way that he once did, that he no longer is engaged intimately with the world and with you the way that he once was. And the next time you have one of the moments that I've kind of mused about this morning, at least stop and ask, God, are you doing something here? Are you trying to get my attention in one way or another? Because for the vast majority of us, how God engages us will be very similar to what we read in Esther, where we never hear his name, we never see the clear signposts, but through all kinds of other things, God is at work, drawing us in, bringing us into alignment with who he is, that we might get on with the great purposes of what he's called us to. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, I love the fact that you are still keenly involved and engaged with your world, with me, with us. And it might not come through burning bushes, it might not come through pillar of clouds, it might not come through giant earthquakes, but through these what appear to be just random events in time, coincidences. And yet when we understand your purpose for our lives and the purpose for this world, these coincidences, oh, they are just your beautiful engagement with us. That we would get out beyond ourselves, think beyond our own lives, be connected into a God who loves, who is pursued, who is bringing about all things new again, and that you've invited us into that world to play as your people. May we at least stop and consider, are you trying to say something? Are you trying to do something? Are you trying to lead me somewhere? In your beautiful name we pray. Amen. Dan is going to come and lead us in a song. The servers for communion are going to come and pass out the elements. I'd ask you just to stay seated while we sing. And then after we're done singing, Gordon's going to come and lead us through the rest of our communion time together.